No job, no home, no money.
Okay.
The day we went number one, the share price went up £44 million. Women weren't allowed to wear trousers in the business.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Francis Curry.
I grew up in Devon in a little town called Ottery St Mary. My mother was a teacher and very supportive. In the school, she was sort of a bit of a dragon, or was known as a bit of a tough nut. And she was certainly very clear about her, for her class, about what she wanted and what level of behaviour she expected. But actually, kids tended to absolutely love her as a teacher. She said something towards the end of her teaching career, which I always absolutely loved. She doesn't see the value in teaching people to remember. She sees the value in helping people to learn. And she had a lot on her plate. Single parent, three kids, looking after an invalid mother and a full-time job as a teacher. So she had a lot of things to juggle. When I was six or seven, my grandfather gave me a Cat's Whiskers radio. And actually, I think that's where my interest in radio very first began. And it was like a little mahogany box. And it had two binding posts for the Bakelite headphones. And it had a bracket where you put the crystal. And then there was another little device that held a single filament of wire that you pressed onto the crystal. And depending on how hard you pressed, affected how good the signal was. I loved working out how all that fitted together and how it worked, taking things apart to work out how they worked. And again, I think that's probably something that's characterised quite a lot of my work, my later interest in things like NLP, but also my consulting. Learning how to model something, how to deconstruct it, understand it, and then be able to either put it back together or, more importantly, replicate the good bits.
And it was at the time what's known in the trade as a turntable hit, which means it got played by everybody on the radio, but the public didn't buy it, which just shows that you can't.
And I remember listening to Annie Nightingale on Radio 1, and there was a feature about hospital radio, and I thought, how amazing. Didn't know that existed. So I wrote to Hospital Radio Exeter, which was based at the Royal Devon Exeter, when I was 10. And out of the blue, on my 16th birthday, I got an email, or not an email, a letter, saying, come and see us. I joined Hospital Radio and spent a couple of years initially ward visiting. And that was interesting because I think I learned something then that I've taken with me ever since, which is it's all about the listener. When you're talking to a little old lady who's got tubes or pipes and is clearly very uncomfortable, and you might be the only person who's been to see her all day or possibly all week, and she asks you for, at the time, Matt Munro, I think there was a profound lesson for me. So when I presented the request show on the Saturday night, having gathered the requests in my school lunchtime, I could picture the person, and I knew how important that song and that message was to that person.
Softly, I will leave you softly.
The other thing that thrilled me was discovering Radio 1 and then Radio Luxembourg. There was no local radio. And when I listened to Radio Luxembourg, I shouldn't even admit this, but I imagined Radio Luxembourg was like a lighthouse. And obviously the studio's at the top because that's where they broadcast from. And obviously downstairs was the living quarters and the bunks. And I sort of imagined this Friends-style situation where everyone lived together, worked together, and it was all about the radio. And listening to people like Rob Jones, Mike Hollis, listening to those people who just were exciting and energetic, and I wanted to be on Radio Luxembourg.
Radio Luxembourg, 208, power play.
The best things to come from George for a long, long time.
Play this week on Radio Luxembourg, 103.
And listening to Radio 1, listening to people like David Jensen and Peter Powell and Simon Bates and Mike Reed, I wanted to be on Radio 1. And I didn't know there was a job apart from being on the radio. I loved radio. You know, I was in this small town, Ottery St Mary. The last bus into the big town, Exeter, was 6 o'clock in the evening. So I imagined being on the radio, being a performer. There was no real evidence I would be very good at it. But I didn't know there was another job, and I knew that was a world I wanted to be involved with.
Currently sitting at number four on the charts, the Bee Gees. And Too Much Heaven, don't forget, there will be a new chart tomorrow. 11 minutes to two.
So I studied French, German, economics and theatre studies to A level. I initially applied to do law at university at Leeds and actually got the grades, got the place. And I just thought, I can't do this. I just cannot. So I wrote to Leeds University and said, nah, it's not happening. And so I ended up having to take a year. And in that year, I did hospital radio. I worked for an insurance company. I applied to go and do theatre studies. But the criteria for deciding, am I going to go to university, was, does it have a radio station? So I rocked up at Warwick University in sort of the autumn of 84. And the first thing I did was found the radio station. And I was very excited and knew a bit more about radio than a lot of the people, simply because I could operate a desk and talk into a microphone without making too much of a mess of it. I got a show very quickly. And I think it was either week two or week three of my first year, they did elections. And I pitched to be the programme controller. And I got it.
Britain's 21st independent local radio station is launched today with the opening of Mercia Sound, covering Coventry, Warwickshire and part of Leicestershire. It means an early
Warwick University is on a separate campus and it sits between Coventry, Kenilworth and Leamington Spa. The local radio station at the time was Mercia. Now, I started in 84 and I think Paul Robinson started on The Breakfast Show on Mercia in Coventry about something like 3 or 6 months before. So, of course, I listened to the local radio station. At some point, I don't remember which year, Mercia came in because they were looking for new sports reporters. So lots of people did the audition at W963, the student radio station. I couldn't. So I and another friend did our own demo afterwards. And, of course, we polished it and edited it and perfected it. So blow me if our demos didn't sound quite good by the time we sent them in. So I subsequently got asked to go in and do some work at Mercia initially as a sports reader on The Breakfast Show, which meant getting up early. I knew less than nothing. I mean, I couldn't type. The training was, there's the printer, there's the typewriter, here's the code to the studio. So I think I did one or two sports shifts. I remember the first one, I didn't know what I was doing. The journalist had a busy day, was too busy to help.
Paul Robinson.
Paul, bless him, was very understanding, but clearly not entirely thrilled. Fortunately, Mercia then decided to do overnights. This time I was slightly more on home territory because it was music radio. I started working part-time for Mercia. Me, Chris Humphreys, who's now at Radio 1 doing compliance, and the gig was 1 till 4 in the morning, still while being a student. So I think I was very nervous, but I got through it. And, you know, as time goes on, I think there's just this slow realisation, certainly in my case, that it's okay not to be very good at things to start with. And the thing is just to keep going, keep doing it, keep practicing. You just got to do the hours. And if you want to become expert at something, then you know, the scientists now tell us it's 10,000 hours. Not very many of us are effortlessly good on day one. Music was entirely up to the presenter, except on Nightbeat, where we clearly had these minutage restrictions and had a very limited repertoire to choose from. We could play some currents and recurrents. And the system then was actually the system that Selector subsequently was based on, where you could choose a song from the first three, a record from the first three in the box. When you played it, you put it to the back. And that was the basic rotation system for the A's. But a lot of the rest of the music, we had to choose based on our own instincts and our understanding of the audience. So there were shopping baskets in the record library. And you would just go around the record library. And we had the night beat and the daybreak section, where all these songs that nobody else would touch, but we knew we had to play X number of those. And there was this label, Arcade Holland. I think Girls in T-Shirts and Open Top Cars was the compilation that sat outside UK needle time restrictions. And the song on there that I chose to open the show with was Brass in Pocket by The Pretenders, because it just made me laugh. We were being paid £7.50 a show.
Francis Curry.
That's a Mercia memory from 1979, The Pretenders with Brass in Pocket. A very good morning to you. In case you're wondering what the voice is, it's Francis Curry on Mercia Sound's new nighttime programme. It's called Nightbeat and I'm with you through until 4 o'clock.
I finished my finals and the next week I started full-time on Mercia doing the overnight shift. Mercia was a phenomenal radio station. When I joined, it had something like a 60% reach. It utterly dominated its patch. It was proper old school, real local radio. So my first week in professional radio, I was on air twice, 1 till 4 a.m. and p.m. And on the Friday, not entirely surprisingly, I crashed the radio car. Mercia Action. Mercia Sound was based in an old working men's club. This was lovely. You'd walk upstairs and there was this team of people, Mercia Action, who did our community service. And I think they were partly government funded. And they worked in what used to be the ballroom at some point. And even though it hadn't been a working men's club for years and years and years, in the middle of the floor, there was still a glitter ball that just stayed forever. People were really proud to work there. I think everybody worked really hard. But one of the characteristics of working there at the time is that really coaching, feedback wasn't part of the culture at all. So literally, for the first few years, once a year, I'd sit down with the boss and he'd go, figures aren't quite what they should be. Sorry, no pay rise. And that was it. And I'd do another year. So I started off doing overnights 1 till 4 in the morning. Then there was a bit of a reshuffle and I took on the late show 10 till 1 at night. I had an absolute ball and we did this thing called the Train of Thought. It was a great competition. Give me one boy's name beginning with B, give me two countries beginning with C, give me three whatever else. And with all the train sound effects, and it became a really popular competition. I remember one night, it was the night of the King's Cross Fire. And I was quite young. I mean, I was really sort of late teens or early 20s. And there was no producer, so I was answering the phones myself and lining them up and trying to keep on top of what was happening in the news. But we had to kind of update people. And I remember sitting there with this terrible tension, trying to figure out, on the one hand, I'm playing this Train of Thought with that name. And on the other, I'm updating people on this King's Cross Fire problem. And I didn't know what to do. And it didn't occur to me to ring up anybody and ask. And nobody rang to say, you shouldn't be doing that. So for that show, I felt utterly conflicted and actually did both. And I still, to this day, well, I do know. I shouldn't have done it, but I did.
Floor, walls and ceiling were alight. And hours after the fire was out, the metal ticket machines were still too hot to touch. Behind them, the remains of the escalator were...
So Angela Bond was the person who used to rep Selector when it was introduced into the UK. And Angela had this fantastic phrase. She used to talk about the studio ballet. And in those early days, and I'm talking here, in my case, sort of 84, 85, 86, you were fast-forwarding, rewinding carts, getting out ad breaks. You were going out and getting your own guests. You were queuing up all the records yourself. There was quite a lot of activity going on between the songs. Interestingly, now you see people who will chain up a sweep and literally have 15 or 20 minutes where they've crafted that sequence in 2 minutes and have nothing to do. And the challenge with that is sometimes that their energy levels and their concentration have dissipated because they haven't had that minimum level of energy and effort required to keep things going. So that studio ballet at that time was an essential component in doing a show.
I'll have the latest travel news, including your road reports and flow factors.
And I'll be giving you the details of a £35 million development on the Alvis site in Coventry.
I was always, if I'm absolutely honest, a little uncomfortable at Mercia because it was so very local. And I'd grown up without any local radio until I was 17, 18, when Devon Air and then BBC Radio Devon came on, that I'd only listened to national radio and local radio in Coventry, and that was really proudly Coventrian. Took me a while to get used to, and I never felt I quite deserved to be there because I was this boy from Devon that happened to have this sort of middle-class education at the university and has blagged his way in. I didn't feel like I was one of the people in the lighthouse lying on the bunk with the radio station upstairs. I was the guy who drove to the lighthouse every day, and I didn't always want to be that. On Mercia Sound. So Mercia, I did the Night Express, as it was called, including Magic at Midnight. And that was funny because I was whatever I was, 19, 20, 21, and I'd have to play these four love songs in a row and then read out a soppy letter. And so what I would do just to keep myself entertained was the four soppy songs would happen on Magic at Midnight. And during those four soppy songs, I would write the letter. And some of the things I used to write, just daft things about relationships or stories. And then you get some feedback from listeners saying, oh, that was really sweet. And it was a complete load of old nonsense that I'd written. Sometimes it was about friends and sometimes it was off TV and sometimes it was just made up stuff. But actually at Mercia, there was a promotions and marketing woman joined just after I did, who became Super Sue very quickly, in the office and on the air. And Sue and I started a relationship, and we are just about to celebrate 32 years together and our 25th wedding anniversary in a couple of weeks. But those letters were never about her. So after Night Express, I was asked to take on mid-mornings. The first hour was the time tunnel, which I really enjoyed. And the test was, can you get 20 songs away? The second hour, I inherited this from Dave Sims. I had to do a Red Rose phone call to a lady with a birthday. And the routine was that you get lots of nominations, literally 20 or 30 nominations. So the nomination would tell you where the nominee was going to be and the phone numbers, and you had to ring up and ask them and surprise them on air, pass on a message, how lovely, then we'd send them a rose. I was quite determined it should include men as well as women, but honestly, I was calling people off the factory floor in Coventry, some blokey bloke who spent all day on the production line of Massey Ferguson. And he and I think the listeners found that all very tricky at the time. I think now nobody would bat an eyelid, but it was a long time ago, a very different time. And then there was the consumer hour. We did the Trading Post twice a week, maybe Mondays and Fridays, where you can buy, sell or swap to a maximum value of £150. But remember, no livestock, firearms or pets. It was a form of radio that was quite challenging to do, that I really admire people who can do it and who do it still. But I found it very hard because it was so far from where I wanted to be and what I wanted to be. I wanted to be on Radio 1. And I didn't see how this was going to get me there. So I think I did mid-mornings for maybe a year, maybe two. And then Stuart called me in and said, look, it's not really working. And of course, there hadn't really been very much feedback in between, apart from the once a year conversation saying, figures aren't that good, no pay rise. At that point, he gave me a choice of moving on to a different show or would let me go. So I left and thought, oh, that might have been a bit rash, actually. I've got nothing to do now and no job and no money.
Britain's best nighttime rock is The Superstation.
And I picked up two bits of work, actually. First of all, Radio, or The Superstation, had by then moved to Manchester. Radio was this idea that I think maybe Richard Branson had, or certainly Richard Branson funded the first one. So the idea was that it would be a sustaining service. So local radio stations clearly had limited resources, and all of them paying for an overnight presenter or a late show presenter when resources were very tight didn't make a lot of sense. So the idea was that they could opt into this network service. Jonathan Ross, Ruby Wax, Johnny Walker, Whispering Bob Harris, Phil Kennedy, Diane Luke, who I'd never come across before. And because as a student and doing those late shifts, I ended up being quite nocturnal. So I listened to a lot of Radio The Superstation, and I loved it because it sort of had a direct line back to Radio Luxembourg, and it felt like this little club, this little gang of people in the middle of the night, and there was something special about it. And I loved all of those presenters.
Listen, we're all here, the whole gang is here, because the whole crew of this little wireless operation we've got going here, all here on the first night. We have Mr. Beasy here, we have Bill Bingham here, some very intelligent here, Bill. We've Carol McTraffic, Nickers is over there. Conjure up the party atmosphere. Can we have a good evening from everyone on the count of three? One, two, three. Good
and then a few years later, I was suddenly on the Superstation. By then, the big names had left, but there were some great people there. So I would also do some holiday cover on Radio in Manchester. So at one point, I was doing sort of midnight till three in Manchester, and then also producing a couple of shows in LBC in London on the same day. And one day I'm sitting down there and Leslie Judd sits down opposite me. Now, Leslie Judd, I grew up with her. She was on Blue Peter and she was always very charming and very likeable. And I don't remember what was going wrong with her day, but she was effing and jeffing and absolutely scorched my ears. And I go, wow. So the LBC thing, I was working on a finance programme, a political programme. I don't even remember what Leslie's programme was. And the radio stuff grew. I mean, that was interesting in itself because by the time I was working on it, it was coming out of the boardroom of Piccadilly Radio in Manchester in Piccadilly Plaza. It was the last business in Piccadilly Plaza. So what greeted you was you'd park the car in the car park upstairs, come down some stairs because the escalators didn't work, and walk through this grey space where half the neon lights didn't work, where there were no businesses, and the only thing that was there were strategically placed buckets to catch the drips from the leaks in the roof. I mean, it couldn't have been less glamorous. And then Radio itself, the superstation, came from the boardroom. So you sat there with a board table and leather chairs down the way. There was a sofa there as well. I was doing a show, and was it Tony Adams? Was actually asleep on the sofa in the same boardroom while I was doing a show. I mean, it was a bit bonkers. So the Radio went bust, and I was gutted because I felt properly at home there. For all it wasn't the glamorous entity it used to be, I felt like this is big, it's national, it's about music. I'm not having to do the woman from the milk marketing board. I can talk about showbiz and rock and roll, and I absolutely loved it.
0345 616 199. If you'd like a dedication on the Superstation, line's open for 5 minutes. Hellos, goodbyes, I love yous, I hate yous. 0345.
And again, didn't work for a short while, apart from to do some cover work on Rock FM. It wasn't like Mercia, it wasn't that very local flavour, and I was doing evenings, so it was slightly younger and more music-focused. The slogan at the time was, best rock, less talk. Now, if you slide into a mid-Atlantic accent, you get best rock, less talk, which sort of works in a slightly cringy way.
Best rock, less talk. Rock FM.
And I knew by then, you know, as a jock, you can just hear the cogs whirring. I just overthought it. I think very often the best players are more spontaneous than I was equipped to be. I cared too much, I tried too hard. I didn't know how to let go. And Colin Walters, he described me as competent. And that was like a knife through the heart. It's like, oh my God, all that work, all that effort and competent is as good as it gets. So that was the moment I thought, you know, presenting is probably not a long-term option for me.
Rock in the Northwest, this is Rock FM 97.4. Question was, which brother left the Christians to set up his own solo career?
So, I didn't work for a little while, and then I got a job at TFM in Teesside. And Brian Lister was the PD there, and this was part of the Metro Radio Group. And they were very curious, in some ways brilliant. They used a music selection system called Muzzcom, which was a complete disaster. Clearly, any system's only as good as the music you put into it, but they put in the Doolies and all kind and Shakin' Stevens, and it could not have been a less cool music mix. Having said that, the radio stations were very successful. But they were also brilliant at coaching and feedback, and it was the first time I'd been introduced to that. And they were also very good at structure. And the summer when Brian Adams' Everything I Do It For You was number one, I played it 4 minutes, 10 seconds ends. I played it in the 4 o'clock hour. I played it in the 5 o'clock hour. And then I played it in the non-stop top 20 in the 6 o'clock hour. Of course, like every presenter, I'm going, this is completely nuts. And Brian, quite rightly, and others pointed out that actually listeners aren't listening to 3 hours. They're listening to one. And they want to hear their favourite song. I mean, that Brian Adams was number one for 16 weeks.
Look into my eyes.
We used to have to say every link. Now with even more of the best music for North Yorkshire and the North East, so you can listen longer on 96.60, this is TFM. And the other requirement was that TFM, you had to go up at the end. And I think it was about momentum and pace. It was mind-blowing. But I thought, interesting, you know, what they were starting to do was tell people what the behaviour was that they wanted. They would tweak the processor during radar periods. They would gently roll off the very top end, the high frequency, because that's the bit that makes things clear, but it's also the bit that's tiring. And I loved that attention to detail. You know, they were thinking about so many different aspects of radio, and I learned a lot from that.
Testing on 104.7 megahertz FM. Minster FM, playing Yorkshire's capital hits.
And then Minster was announced and got ready for launch, and they advertised for a programme controller. I applied, but I didn't get the job as programme controller the first time, because I had no experience. Somebody called Dara Corcoran got the gig and did a fantastic job on the music. Brilliant. And then I think week one or week two, he decided, for whatever reason, I think it was because he decided management wasn't for him, I got a call. Would you still be interested? Absolutely. So I joined Minster. That was where I really was straddling both. I was doing the management thing, doing the music thing, and doing the on-air thing. And I think it became apparent to me that of the three, the bit I was doing least well, partly because inevitably you end up in that job where there's not enough hours in the day, doing the S&P meeting in the studio while the show's on. I mean, you would never allow that today. So I was at Minster for a year, 18 months. It may have been a little bit longer, actually. And then I saw a job advertised for Invicta in Kent and was lucky enough to get the job as programme manager, I think it was, part of Southern Radio at the time, with Jeremy Scott and Guy Hornsby being the two leads, both great, passionate people. And I learned a lot from them just in terms of how to build a team spirit. And that's where I really had the headroom to start to think a bit more strategically about what we were doing, how we were structured, what we were trying to be. Now, I covered a couple of shows, and I think it's really important, is I sat down, I discovered the chair was uncomfortable. So after an hour and a half of a three-hour show, my back was hurting a bit. And I discovered the cart machines that we used to do three-way splits at Invicta, the pinch wheel squeaked. And in terms of studio ergonomics, the door opened behind the presenter. When you don't want to be blindsided by somebody coming into a room behind you when you can't see and can't hear. So I think remembering how it feels to be a presenter was something that I realised how important that was. And I've tried to keep that with me. If I had my time again, I would do more coaching. I did do coaching. I started coaching. But I did it without a great degree of confidence and without any proper sense of structure. Managing upwards was something I wasn't very good at. I'm still not very good at. I like to be given a job and get on with it. But we had some real success there. You know, the audience grew dramatically. The other thing that I learned as a manager was to make sure you really get to know the talent. In the old school world, a manager would have one way of managing. In the very old school world, that would tend to be command and control. But situational management is all about learning to adapt your style to the individual. In other words, what's important is not what you say. What's important is what they hear. Because typically, most people want to do a good job. But very often, if you watch an interaction, you can see completely different languages not understanding each other.
Somehow we make the great songs sound even better. This is Invicta FM.
So what happened then was that Capital Radio bought Southern Radio. One day, Richard Park and David Mansfield drove down to Invicta, kicked the tyres and talked to all of us. And actually, we're in pretty good shape because we'd had a couple of very strong jikras, as they were then. They wanted to be reassured that the people there knew what they were doing, but clearly they had bigger fish to fry. There was an incident, though, where it was a real test of my mettle and Richard's. I was on a day off. We had a freelance journalist, and they were using some copy that was sent in by a stringer. And this is about somebody who had been abducted, and then this person had later been thrown out of the car at speed. It turned out that person had also been sexually assaulted, at which point we should not have named them. I got a call the next day from some court official demanding that I attend court to explain why I was in contempt of court. So there was me and the editor of the Times. We both had the same mistake on our titles. And I had to ring Richard Park, who I'd met once, and say, Richard, bit of a situation here. He was brilliant. He asked me two or three very clear questions and then said, do you want me to come? And I was able to say, no, I think we've got it under control. Me, the editor and the barrister had to go to court. The worst outcome would have been a prison sentence or a mistrial. But in the end, that the barrister stood up and made a proper, formal, full and frank apology. The judge accepted it. And it was never mentioned again.
You heard Brenda? She's brilliant. Warm overnight tonight, 15 degrees Celsius the low for Friday. Dry, humid and warm, 24 degrees the high.
So That was Invicta, and then what happened was Richard asked me if I would go to BR&B. And BR&B was obviously a big city radio station. It had Les Ross doing the breakfast show. Now, I'd lived in Leamington and Coventry previously, so was aware of the big Midlands personalities. Interestingly, Les sat me down quite early on and said, "You're the programme controller, you'll be here 2 years, then you'll go, and I'll still be here." I'm not sure how deliberate it was, but it was a, "You're a visitor, I'm embedded here." And he was right, I did almost exactly 2 years. But in that time, Clive had left a radio station that was in very good shape. It thought big, it behaved big. So the whole approach was treating it like a mini capital. But that same attitude, or that swagger.
To be the number one hit music station, it's not just what you play, it's the way you play them. And we play them better than anyone
Steve
else.
Priestley and Phil Upton and Carlos and Charlie Jordan. It was a stellar lineup that was properly Midlands Birmingham, rooted to its patch, proud of its patch. It was a champion.
On my previous radio station, I'd like to mention Extra if I can help it, but I used to do an hour on a Saturday morning. It was recorded so I could actually hear myself. And I once went in a hair salon. It doesn't show now.
Les had worked in that patch for a very long time. He knew it inside out and back to front. He was so funny and so clever and so spontaneous. My first experience of really understanding what it meant to manage somebody of that caliber was Les. And I think what we ended up with was a very good relationship where we just have an open and frank conversation, absolutely not tell him what to do. And I would talk to him saying, "I'm just wondering what would happen if we did this, or how would it sound if we did that?" So it was very much a collegiate approach. It was very respectful. Equally, he was grateful to have somebody who didn't command and control, but somebody who was interested and was keen to keep him moving. We also had a couple of good producers. And, you know, producers have the most difficult job in the world. They're part of the management team and they're part of the talent team, and they have to straddle that world all the time in real time. The other thing about BR&B was the focus on music. Mark Sadler was the head of music. And we were absolutely obsessed with getting the music right. Now, some of the games we played were so funny. So, for example, the record reps would come in and they'd say, "We can't give you this yet, but have a listen to this." And we would play it on a hi-fi on the desk. We were recording it in the studio next door to make sure we had a pristine copy of the record we weren't allowed to have yet. So then when the song had gone, we would send it to another part of Capital, who would then break it so that the chain between us recording it and them playing it was completely broken, and then we'd pick up on it. I also learned about research there. We worked with BP&R. It was a fairly clunky system, but for me, it was an introduction to what is now called data-driven decision-making. But what you have to remember is research is just people's opinions. And normally, it's the people's opinions whose opinion you value most. And I loved it because it provided me with some support for that listener focus. As soon as you've got third-party insight or data or understanding, then it diffuses the situation because you can say, "Well, let's find out. Let's ask." Music research, hook-based music research, came out of MTV in America. And they had a researcher called Steve Casey. And Steve Casey figured out that if you played people bits of music, they would have a response. And what's interesting to me now is if you sit in a car with somebody who's not in radio, watch them going through the radio stations, people will typically give a music station 2 or 3 seconds to decide whether they're going to stay listening or not. I'd sometimes do this thing in trainings where I'll do a virtual music test where I will play people short clips. And I'll ask them, "I want you to notice 2 things. First of all, how quickly your opinion forms. And secondly, how you know." Most people will have a physical reaction. And the trouble is, if you give them longer, people start overthinking it. And they start thinking about, "Well, what does that say about me? And what my friends think if they know I like that song?" And what you're always trying to do is short circuit that overthinking and get people's immediate, spontaneous, emotional response.
Always a better song. Always
96.4 FM, BRMB.
Richard Park was the group PD, and he would come up to Birmingham every quarter, and we'd typically do a Rajar debrief. We'd do a night out, and the trick was to make sure that I picked him up at the train station, that he was dropped at his hotel, that he was looked after every step of the way, that we had the VIP passes to the nightclub. I always found him very supportive, mercurial, and interesting. To sit and listen to an hour of your radio station with Richard was amazing, because there was this, he would listen to a certain amount of the output, and you could see he was open and it was just washing over him. And then at some point, he would hit the stop button. And it was almost like he would then rewind and work out what all those bits, how they affected him as he was listening to it. So he could sort of review the emotional journey he had while he was listening to the music or the presenter. I think of the 6 or 8 program controller departures in the previous 2 years, there was only one who had left under his own volition. And I became aware that if there was excess, I wouldn't necessarily get the credit. If there was a problem, I would definitely get the blame. I was approached by a headhunter to go and be the programme director of Melody FM.
This is Melody FM on 105.4, the time exactly 1 o'clock.
And Melody was curious. It was owned by Lord Hanson. It was very, very conservative, old-fashioned. Women weren't allowed to wear trousers in the business. And I think it became clear after I joined that really my job was to polish it up for sale. So Melody was an old format radio station. Nat King Cole, Matt Munro, Nelson Riddle Orchestra, all in daytime. The active library was over 4,000 songs. But then, of course, it was bought by EMAP. We started the process of relocating it and of renaming it so it could become part of the Magic portfolio. And that was an interesting game, because we did what I think was a really good game in terms of rebranding the radio station. We took our time. We took something like 6 months. And I think it's one of the very few examples where we were able to rebrand the radio station and simultaneously grow the audience.
Enjoy your lunchtime with London's Magic 105.4 Melody FM.
The other thing I really got introduced to for the very first time was a marketing department, and this idea that it wasn't just what came out of the speakers. It was also what you said about what came out of the speakers that was important. And there was a guy in charge of EMAP marketing called Malcolm Cox, who is brilliant. We argued like cat and dog, and I was clearly out of my depth and not always right, funnily enough. But the first advert we had for Magic, awful green logo, just a horrible colour, and a spacey creative where we played Fat Larry's band Zoom, and then there was a dog in this slightly surreal world that flapped its ears. And I think it may have flown away, but I don't even remember very well now. And I just could not understand how that related to the radio output I was creating. And I think probably it would have saved a lot of time if we'd had a more grown-up conversation about needing to change perception, and that to do that, sometimes you have to go too far to break a perception and create a new one. And I think those adverts, with hindsight, were good. They got people talking, and they really did a good job of making Magic arrive in London.
On Magic 105.4. And why? It's 4:10.
Tim Schoonermaker, who was chief exec of EMAP at the time, said, we've got this TV channel called The Box. It's lost money for 7 years. And basically the brief was fix it or fold it. So that The Box thing went really well. And then we worked on the launch of Kiss TV, QTV. I was invited to go and be music director for EMAP Performance. Now, Performance was a brilliant idea, slightly too far ahead of its time. Chrysalis were looking for somebody to be the PD of Heart. So I had a couple of meetings. I did a psychometric test, which I failed. I mean, who fails a psychometric test? But I did. My results were impossible. But they're my results. Heart in London was suddenly my new home. I think when I walked in, there had been a real loss of confidence. There had been this idea that they would sort of be capital light. But what that meant strategically was they had a slightly softer, slightly lighter, with all due respect to everybody involved, second-rate capital. The strategic job was to find a new direction and give it a sense of purpose. The cultural job was to help people believe in this radio station again. So I remember a meeting in the canteen where I'd only been there a week or two, and I had to present a new vision. Just outlined this vision that it would be a first-rate heart, not a second-rate capital, and it would target 30, 39-year-old women, and it would be a glossy, stylish, upmarket brand, and blah, blah, blah. And of course, Steve Parkinson, the MD, not only loved it, but was 100% supportive and involved in some of that thinking, because his background's marketing. And we did an AMT, a music test. It was interesting. It came back very clearly, sort of handbag classics. The era split was roughly 270s, 280s, 290s, two noughties, two recurrents, two A's. And I said, well, let's just put it on the air, which was unheard of. It didn't sound like anything else because it was new and old. Capital and Kiss were competing for who could be the coolest club in town and a lot of difficult underground mixes. And we were playing Shalimar and just big dance songs. In terms of the lineup, you know, one of the difficult things is when you have to talk to people who have influenced you or who you've really admired and say, I'm sorry, but this isn't the right thing anymore. We need to go in a different direction. So I had some very difficult conversations. They're never fun. And when you have those conversations with some of the greats in broadcasting, you sort of have to do as much as you can to leave them with their integrity and with their confidence intact and have them understand that it's not that they've done anything wrong or they're not very good. It's just that we need to go in a different direction now. Toby Anstice was doing, I think at this point, one overnight show a week and was on his way out. Previous management had decided he wasn't right for the radio station or wasn't right for the brand. So he was working his notice doing overnights. So when Chris Farrell went travelling, I got Toby in to do afternoons. Then he subsequently moved forward to mid-mornings where he stayed for 16 years, 17 years.
Kylie and Patty Austin and James Ingram before that. Nice chill-out tune. And Luther and Mariah as well. Endless Love. It's more music variety.
The big one, though, was Breakfast. And typically when you update a radio station, it's the last thing you do. And I had heard Jamie Theakston more than 10 years before on Radio 1. He used to do a Saturday morning show for a while. And I remember thinking, he's good. So when we were thinking about, well, what fits this new updated heart image, Jamie popped into my head. Went round to his flat, had a few chats. He was quite interested in the idea because everybody was very nervous because Jono Coleman was working with Harriet Scott and I'd brought in Harriet and Erica North had done it before and done a great job. So we did an audition with Jamie and we did it at Capital. There was a production facility in the back of Capital Radio. So we hired it and smuggled Jamie in and me separately and somebody else who was facilitating this to record a demo in their back garden. Sounded really good. And this is just before Christmas. I then had to drive up to the Midlands to Phil Riley's house to drop off the tape. And I was very confident. I said, look, I'll put my career on the line for this. I think it's the right thing to do for the radio station. And Phil looked at me and said, it's going to take more than that. It's going to take mine as well. So anyway, we did. We made this pitch to Richard Huntingford, who was Chrysalis Group CEO, and they bought it. It was a ballsy move, particularly because Jamie's radio experience was very limited. And he obviously not only pulled it off, what is it now, 16, 17 years later, he's still doing Breakfast on Heart and still doing a brilliant job. Very proud. Heart's changed a lot in the last couple of years, but until a couple of years ago, you know, there are still some of my fingerprints on it. I'm not very good at looking backwards. I'm slightly allergic to the past, but I'm very proud of the change we made. Capital Radio had been number one in London for 30 years. We beat them for the first time in 30 years. We were so excited. I ended up with a case of Cristal champagne on my desk. I think the day we went number one, the share price for Chrysalis went up £44 million. It was phenomenal. So I don't remember the name of the pub next door, but I do know we went there. And I do know we got a massive cheer when we walked in, but we were so excited. And I think compared with where we'd started off, feeling and behaving like an underdog and a not such a good... I think the Birmingham Heart at the time was much stronger than the London Heart. And actually turning that around to be London's market-leading commercial radio station was phenomenal. I'll never forget it.
The Sony station of the year is Heart 106.2.
The programme director is Francis Curry. The marketing controller...
One of the things about moving to Heart was I was suddenly working with a different calibre of presenter. I was suddenly dealing with master communicators. These are very smart, very articulate people.
It's Michael Bublé on Heart Breakfast. 8:15, we are live from Warner Brothers Studio Tour London, the making
of... And I felt that if I wanted to really help them, I needed to up my skills. I wanted a better insight into how to manage people more effectively. So that started the NLP journey. A friend had talked to me about NLP previously, neuro-linguistic programming, which has a very mixed reputation. I think increasingly it's getting rebranded as neuroscience. At its heart, NLP is about modelling. How people at the top of their field, like Virginia Satir, who was a child therapist, do their work. How do they get the results they get? What are the essential components? Can we sort of model those components out? And then critically, can we recreate it to a similar standard? So I started a journey which took me through 20 days of NLP training to be a practitioner, 20 days to be a master practitioner, 20 days to be a coach, and then 20 days to be a trainer. And it's given me, I think, on a good day, an incredibly flexible toolkit to know how to communicate more effectively, how to help people understand things more easily. Ultimately, depending on the situation, give people a lot more control over what they do. Also, sometimes when it comes to writing production or writing content for the radio.
Almost 16 minutes to six on a very chilly Monday evening across the East Midlands. This is Heart playing Irene Cara. Flash
so
dance.
I then became Group PD for Heart, working across all three. And another rebrand, which was great fun in Nottingham. And Sam and Amy, who now are on Virgin, and who did something like 10 years on Heart in Nottingham as presenters. At the time when I first met them, Sam was the drive time presenter and Amy was the drive time co-presenter, who was actually a full-time student. Sam and Amy are, and always were, very different characters. This is a massive and a slightly rude over-characterisation. But if Sam is the happy, big-footed, licky puppy, then Amy is the cool cat. And I think that's a very interesting dynamic.
Has anyone man for the job? It's the man you two both look up to and admire.
There's no way you're doing
day.
It.
You're not qualified.
You will mess it up.
Commercial programming, S&P, is a complicated area. If you imagine it as concentric circles, then you've got three. The client, the radio station, and you've got the presenter. And your perfect radio promotion is built in the overlap of the three concentric circles in the Venn diagram. Those are hard to pull off, but when you do, it's magic. I really enjoyed working with the S&P team or with the commercial programming teams, and it was really hard because their job is to fight for the client. Commercial is a short-term game. It's about this week's target, this month's target, this quarter's target. Programming is a long-term game. What you do today, what you do next week or next month, will be impacted in a year. So the biggest source of tension between commercial and content is always timescale. So there was a promotion where they wanted to do a toilet duck promotion. Don Thompson and I, who was the commercial director for the Chrysalis group, or the radio group, not just Heart, and I were in a room and standing and shouting at each other. And it was worth it. And I don't know what we... I don't even remember what we did, but I know we were... He was absolutely determined to take the money. And I was absolutely determined that we weren't going to talk about toilet duck on breakfast. one morning. I've come back from a summer holiday. And I get called into a meeting with Richard and Ashley, bought by Global. Richard's standing by the window, looks out and says, "Isn't it a lovely day?" And I'd known both of them previously because of our relationship at Capital Radio many years before. Essentially, they told me they were making my role redundant. And I think me, the marketing director and the managing director got binned in 10-minute meetings. Mine didn't even last 10 minutes. And I was then almost shooed out of the building because I wanted to pack up my desk and take my things. And I wanted to say goodbye to people. And we'd just moved to the Cotswolds. So we were living in a rented house that didn't have a phone signal, didn't have an internet connection. And all of my paperwork, contracts and everything was all in storage. So it was a bit of a moment where you kind of go, oh, I've suddenly gone from a very clear role and focus and job to lots of fresh air and no money. I rang a few people and talked to a few people. And of course, one of the realities is in that situation, you discover how many people were friends because you were in the running and they were not real friends. I had quite a lot of that, especially with the music industry. So I took stock. And the other thing that happened at roughly the same time was we'd sold a house in London. We were renting in the Cotswolds with a view to buying. And at the recommendation of our financial advisor, we'd put all of our money, every penny we had, in AIG. And then the crash happened and AIG got shut down. So suddenly every penny we had was not accessible. We didn't have anything. All of our savings, all of the money from selling the house, was all not available. In the end, it all came back. But for a time there, no job, no home, no money. Okay. I had always had this idea that in the first stage of your life, you learn. In the second stage of your life, you do. And then the third stage of your life, you teach. And I think it's a sort of Eastern philosophy. And I'd certainly approached quite a lot of my radio career with development of people in mind. So I set up as a business trainer and executive coach. And I got some work. I taught Macmillan nurses influence and persuasion skills. This was building on the NLP stuff I'd done before. And the reason they need them, by the way, is because they've got patients who are often very difficult, family members who are not in a rational state. Macmillan nurses have to get people to do what they need. So it turned out to be a very useful set of skills that had never occurred to me. So I ran that. I then got a phone call. This is the test of how entrepreneurial are you. I got a phone call from somebody. So he rang me up on a Friday afternoon and said, would you teach negotiation skills to 20 international Allen and Overy lawyers on Monday? They are one of the big international law firms. And I said, yes. It was such an interesting dance to do, to put myself that far out there, to say yes and then figure it out. And I was so nervous and I was so pleased afterwards. I was utterly exhausted. But what happened was some radio stuff started walking in the door. Would you mind giving us a hand with this or would you give a hand with that? Steve Casey, who's the man who had invented Hook music research a million years before, had done some music research for us at Heart, rang me up and said, I've got a client in Slovakia who would like some consulting. Are you up for it? And that started my international consulting. And interestingly, in a lot of Europe, people look to London for ideas and inspiration. In the same way that we used to look to America 10 or 20 years before, now people look to London so everybody knew the Heart story. So that started my consulting career, which actually ran for 10 years. And for year one, I earned about a quarter of what I'd earned the year before as Group PD of Heart. Year two, I earned the same. For the remaining 8 years, I earned more.
Best mix.
Signal one.
First day of halftime, let's get you through it.
I was working a lot internationally and I was asked to work with UTV. And I spent a couple of years, maybe more, working as their acting group programme director for their local radio stations across the UK. Fast forward a couple of years, I got a phone call from Scott. And originally, I was asked to do the research for the relaunch of Virgin. So I was working with Niklas Nordén, who's a Swede, who's a brilliant business partner. He's the best man I know on research and on music. Niklas and I did a market study for Virgin. And then we did a music study. So we presented the research, which was very clear, and a recommended strategy. And for whatever reason, the radio station at that time went in a different direction. So it launched well, and then it had two or three tricky radars. So I got the call to say, look, would you mind coming back in and working with the management team at Virgin? So I started working part-time. And Scott said to me quite quickly, look, there's so much going on here. There's stuff in Ireland, where we own six radio stations. There's the ILRs, which have gone backwards a bit. And there's Virgin, which isn't quite firing on all cylinders. There's so much here. Would you come and work with us full time? So I thought that is a fascinating project. Plus, wireless is now part of News UK. And when you've got brands like The Times, The Sunday Times, The Sun, that's a really interesting portfolio. So I joined full time. The priority to start with was Virgin, but it became very apparent that needed a lot of love. So Mike Cass rang me and said, I'm back in the UK. Do you fancy a lunch? And by the end of the lunch, he got himself a job as PD of Virgin in London. Brilliant programmer. It was very obvious very quickly that particularly with the news influence, there was a big ambition for Virgin. This was expected to earn its place at the top table. So we did work on the music and we did work on the imaging and we did work on the lineup and we changed quite a lot of things to make it make sense. But then it also became apparent that we needed a really big idea. And I had known Michael Foster for many years. He's one of the big London agents. It became apparent that Chris was ready for a move. That's a very long story, very short. And it included me being on holiday, walking this, with the kids, getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, walking the streets of Manhattan, having conversations with Michael, trying to get a few bits and pieces sorted. But in the end, it was the most amazing thing where Chris decided that he was up for moving to Virgin. Imagine moving from the biggest show, not just in the UK, not just on Radio 2, but the biggest radio show in Europe, to a radio station with around about 300 and something thousand listeners.
Some of us are mountain climbers. And if you get to the top of your favourite mountain and you just stay there, then you become a mountain observer. And I need to keep climbing.
Chris is without doubt the premier radio talent in the country. If you want to talk how to manage somebody like that, a lot of the job is facilitate and get out of the way. But the other bit was the masterstroke, which was doing a deal with Sky that meant it was commercial free. I mean, that was also groundbreaking in its own right. And that meant that the content from Sky was heavily embedded in the same way that the BBC content was embedded in the Radio 2 show. The Sky content was embedded in the Virgin show.
We're commercial free. I mean, you know, we have a commercial partner in Sky, but we are ad-free. There are no ads on the show for at least the
next
100 years.
It was madness because, of course, we did the first show from a new building. We launched two offshoot radio stations, Virgin Radio Anthems, Virgin Radio Chilled, and we launched the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with as much fanfare as we could. Chris, I mean, he was still outside the studio at 6:27 and the show starts at 6:30. We've got Richard Ashcroft and a full live band, I think there are 11 of them, including singers, singing live for the very first song at 6:30. I mean, God knows how many microphones that was. And then at the end of the first sweep, and he hadn't even been on for the full 12 weeks, he'd been on for 9 or 10 of the full weeks, he hit a million listeners on Breakfast. I mean, it was the most extraordinary thing. And then the second sweep, the audience for the radio station is now up over 1.5 million. It's still growing at an extraordinary rate when you consider it's got no FM, no AM. It's only DAB. It's D2. But it is one of the great turnaround stories led by the talent and the appeal of one man who is a force of nature.
Looks like my colleagues might live.
So the Virgin project, the wireless project, took 2 years. And in the summer, it was time for me to kind of move on because it all felt like it was working right. And I'm returning to consulting. And the idea of working for myself again, the idea of having so many different things to juggle and play with is just as exciting as it was to be working with Virgin and the team at Wireless. And I'm pleased to say they're my most important and my biggest first client. So I still have a great relationship with them. So I start this new chapter just as excited as I was every previous time I've started a new chapter. I can't wait to get properly stuck into it again. I wish I had been on Radio 1. Who knows what would have happened if you'd taken a different path? Honestly, I still love my work. And I can look forward and be excited about working for another 5, 10, 15, 20 years. I can't seriously have any regrets. because it's been the most brilliant adventure so far, and it ain't finished yet. I think some of the best radio we've ever had in this country is right now. I feel so sorry for the people who've worked in local radio, given heart and soul to it, and lost their place. The good thing is, if you're good at communications, then there is a world of opportunity out there if you can see it. But if you listen to radio today, if you look at the explosion of choice, I think it's really exciting. And there are various risks. You know, the big risk is we try and compete with Spotify by being Spotify. The other risk is we try and compete with podcasts by just talking all the time. The value in radio is the mix, certainly in music radio, of personality, engagement, content, music. You know, is it interesting, entertaining, or useful? Does it speak to your head, your heart, or your hand? It's all of the things together that make radio so good. And I think the danger for us is if we isolate them all out and don't recognise that actually it's the mix. Whether it's at work or in real life outside work, to be profound, did you leave the people you worked with in a better place than you found them? You know, I'm proud of Heart, I'm proud of Virgin, I'm proud of Magic, I've loved the consulting, but in the end, it's about the people. Did you do something useful? I hope I did.
Francis Curry. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast.